Okay. The House Committee on Revenue for February 3rd, 2016 will come to order. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4027. Paul? And then Jody, you're signed up for this bill. Please move up to the witness table, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 4027 is a committee bill introduced for the session. Its origin is, as you know, we've spent a lot of time working on tax expenditures in recent years, starting with House Bill 2067, 2009, with the credit sunsets. We are now doing a credit report on a regular biennial basis. Department of Revenue has done tax expenditure reports since 1995. But this bill is really a placeholder to look at some other potentially tax expenditures to bring them into a more formalized review process, and that's the intent of the bill.
Thank you. Before we hear from Jody, is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Jody, go ahead, please.
Chair Barnhart. So I want to say that aside from the social policy issues that are being that will be passed this session, this is probably the most important bill that we'll see passed, because we are spending billions in tax expenditures that we're not currently reviewing in any systematic way. And when LRO developed our last bill that we did this kind of review for income tax expenditures, it has really made a difference in the way we go back and consider what we're doing. And I think this is critical. A few years ago, we looked at all the new tax breaks of various kinds for economic development subsidies and found that in a 10-year period, we're now spending $700 million more per biennium on tax breaks for economic development. And that many of those programs aren't examined at this point in time, and this will give us a chance to examine them. So I'm hopeful that it will pass through both houses. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comment about this being an extremely important bill, and of course we have a lot of a variety of tax breaks out there in the world that ought to be examined on a very regular basis.
And over the last couple sessions, we've actually seen bills where we removed sunsets from bills. And it was like, that kind of flies in the face of the other idea we had that we should be examining our sunset, our legislation periodically, the same way we examine the budget every 2 years. So, or similar to how we examine the budget every 2 years.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4027. Colleagues, we have two other hearings scheduled today. The significant one is we have the Oregon Society of CPAs waiting to be heard on House Bill 4025. What I'd like to do is hold the committee at ease for a couple of minutes and hope that we get more members here. There's a lot of other things going on in the House right now, and I'm hoping that those meetings will break up quickly so that we can actually get back to work. Please don't wander off. The committee will stand at ease. I'm hoping only a couple of minutes. Okay.
All right.
The committee will come back to order. Colleagues, while you were gone, we disposed of House Bill 4027. With the public hearing. We had a very good but short public hearing on that bill. We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 4025. Let's hear a little bit about the bill, and then we'll hear from the CPAs who made a special trip down here to give us the report that you have in front of you today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4025 is the annual reconnect bill. Oregon makes the decision to be connected to federal tax policy, and so all of the references to the Internal Revenue Code in statute are updated by this measure, and it affects various types of programs. It has updates to references in the governing statutes of the public employees retirement system, and that is a connection to federal law that establishes taxable income, affects annual benefits payable to members, and specifies rules around minimum distribution requirements under certain circumstances, and relates to benefits and service credit for a period in the uniform services. It also updates the connections to federal code that define shareholders and S corporations who may present or represent their companies in proceedings before the tax court. And then there are some other connections that are changed in there. The Dash 1 amendment also was something that was brought up, but it was needed administratively in order to connect filing deadlines to federal filing deadlines in some cases. And so that amendment has been added and is reflected in all this.
Very good. Thank you very much. We'll hear from the Oregon Society of CPAs, Heather Jackson, Suzanne Leidick, and Gary Holcomb, please. Thank you so much for being here today. I have to tell you that for me, your report as a society is one of the highlights of the early part of a legislative session, because we start learning more about the intricacies of federal tax law and how they interact with our state tax system. Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Glad you appreciate it. Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Gary Holcomb, representing the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a state and local tax practitioner with the firm Vernst & Young.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Heather Jackson. I represent OSCPA. I am a tax manager at Dougal Conradi, a local firm in Beaverton.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Susanna Leidick. I'm here for Oregon Society of CPAs. I am a tax senior at Moss Adams.
Great. Thank you.
Well, I'll get going. And when we looked at, I have last year's versus this year, and we weren't trying to create more paper, but it is a substantial packet this year, and partly because of what the federal changes were, and partly because of some of the ways we presented it, it's because there were so many changes, we kind of left things broader, and so you could see very specific provisions. But as in prior years, I think the most important thing to understand, the reason we're here is to promote the conformity and to serve, I guess, it's to serve as a technical resource first for you, not advocating one way or the other. But we do believe that the permanent connection and the fixed date conformity really do ease a lot of taxpayer administration and makes our lives easier, but also a lot of the taxpayers when it does connect to the federal code. You know, the front page of it talks a little bit about it, but just to level set you, that the only thing that currently for determining taxable income that we're disconnected from in Oregon is the domestic production activities credit, also referred to as Section 199, and Oregon's been disconnected from that since 2011, as well as the federal subsidy for prescription drugs. So those are the two that that the legislature has chosen to disconnect from in the past and has kept that going since 2011. So there's a lot here, and please, you know, we don't have, it doesn't have to be formal. We can answer questions between the three of us, hopefully, at any point. What I think is, as we go through this, I'll start with some of the items, but the thing to really concentrate on is this. In prior years, a lot of these things have been the extenders package, and it extends 1 year. And really, by extending 1 year, what that meant is the year after it really applied to the prior year. So last year, when they extended in 15, it was really allowing it for 14. So then they had to do something again at the end. Congress had to do something again at the end of 15 to get it through 16. This year was different than the last three sessions of Congress in that they actually chose to permanently connect the, to permanently allow some of these deductions, and also to extend them, some for 2 years, some for several years, but none of them were just for kind of the retro year being retroactive year being of 2015. So with that, I'll go through and I'll try to reference some page numbers, and we'll go through line by line, but obviously we won't hit every one of these or you guys wouldn't be here. To reference you again on what the sections mean, Section A means that Oregon would automatically reconnect to these provisions and follow the federal tax code unless the legislature chose to do something different and disconnect as in those other two examples. The Section Bs that we'll talk about are that we don't think there's any Oregon change necessary. It deals things with like credits or other items. So we don't think there's any change necessary, but wanted to make sure that you knew that there were the changes. Section C is that we do think that there's a change needed. Section D is these are kind of non they reference the tax code, but they really aren't tax law, so the Oregon doesn't need to connect, but just, again, be relevant for you. And then Section E is things that we think that you should just be aware of that we haven't necessarily analyzed because they really don't impact the income tax law. So we'll cover some of these. So if we refer to Section A, which is on page 1, things like the Section 61, you know, we're going to say power, the coal power grants are still excluded from income, so it's granting a tax deduction to certain coal power plants. For items like that, I think you guys can, if you have questions, you can just ask. Otherwise, I'll just point them out and move on. The Section 62, though, I thought you may find interesting, is that is extending the teachers' deduction, so teachers can take a deduction for expenditures in their classroom that they make up to $250 a year. This one now includes also professional development that they would have to have and can take that as a deduction. This one now, instead of just an extension, it is made permanent as the teacher's deduction. The next page on page 2, that's a mere clarification on the first one. The second one, which is the home mortgage forgiveness, that again on the discharge of debt after the Great Recession last time, Congress allowed mortgage debt forgiveness for certain individuals, and that's been extended for 2 years. So when I say extended for 2 years, that means every time I say that, it's 15, which was last year you'll file, and 16 being this current year. So it'll be allowed. The next one is Section 117, and that just expands the what college-age persons can take as an exclusion from income to be a work-learning service program. So it's similar to like a scholarship that they don't have to count as income. And again, that is made permanent. The next one on page 3 is 132, and that's the $250 exclusion for transit benefits, whether it's parking or mass transit. You can exclude that from your personal income, and that one is made permanent as well. The next one, the 139F, is just damages for wrongful incarceration are made permanently excludable from income. 163H is the mortgage insurance premium, and that deduction is extended through 16, so again, the two-year extension. The last 164 is the state sales tax. And you can claim, instead of claiming income tax as an itemized deduction, you can claim sales tax as an itemized deduction, and that is made permanent as well. All right, so now we get to the fun stuff. On for the next, I guess, 10 pages, it is depreciation. So you'll see all these starting with 168, and I'll try to cover these. A lot of them are very similar and in general, but at one point Oregon was disconnected from depreciation in the same years that they disconnected from the 199 deduction that I mentioned earlier. You have to remember that depreciation is only a timing difference, right? It is not a permanent deduction. You're not doing something. You're either going to pay the tax now or you're going to pay it later. It's just when you're going to be able to take that deduction. So I'll highlight some of these differences. Is what has made difference, the biggest difference obviously on this is some certain building improvements under that first one for restaurants and other items are made permanent, that they can qualify for some of these deductions. The next ones you guys usually like to hear about, it's things like racehorses, motorsports entertainment groups, those items. So just certain items that Congress decided would be allowed for bonus depreciation. One specific one I'll mention is at the bottom of page 5, and that is the increase in depreciation for cars that are qualified property. So for certain companies and individuals, you can take that deduction, and it's been increased to $8,000, and that's extended for 5 years. Later on, you'll see a section, and I won't cover it then. They actually extended it for 5 years, but then they put a phase in, a phase out, starting in 2018. It's going to go to $6,400. Then in 19, it'll be $4,800. So it's in. It was extended for 5, but now it's really only extended for 3, and then it's changed for the other two. So The next page is the top of page 6 is the 168K2. That is what that is the typical thing you would consider as bonus depreciation. So again, that is the 5-year extension of that, similar to the cars that I just mentioned. So it will be 5 years. However, just like the cars, they said, okay, it's extended for 5 years, but we're only going to allow the 50% bonus depreciation for 15 to 17, and then it will drop to 40% in 18 and 30% in 19. So if the legislature doesn't make any changes, we would follow those same types of rules going forward with Oregon.
And as you pointed out, this simply changes the timing.
That's correct, right? If you have a $100 asset and you take $50 in the first year instead of, say $20 per year.
Right.
So in the end, you take $100. It's just a matter of when you take that $100. A lot of these other ones are technical, but I did think, just given our state, that you may be interested on page 9. They changed the rules for plants bearing fruit or nuts. And so that would obviously impact Oregon agriculture and industry. So that gives them those people bonus depreciation. And I think more importantly, it changes the way that they determine when an item is placed in service. Before, fruit and nut trees were only determined to be placed in service when they started producing. And obviously it takes a while for a fruit and nut tree to produce. So they said it's when it's actually planted that can count towards that cost instead of waiting those 5 years. So since this is only a 5-year extension again, a lot of the trees would never get to the bonus depreciation standpoint, and now they will.
This apply to grapevines?
I'm assuming so.
And that's one of our major
competitive
sector crops is a wine. So
I would assume with fruit that it actually would.
Yeah.
Let's use the word plants.
Yeah.
Versus trees.
Yeah. Let's on page 11. I'll go through. Page 10. Biofuel plant property is extended to 17 for 2 years. And then on page 10 through 11, there's a number of just conservation easement changes that allow individuals and certain corporations to qualify for a conservation easement and take the deduction for that. On page 12, 170 is an increase in the charitable contribution from food inventory. So a grocery store or other food producer that may increase that, you can now, instead of just a 10% limitation on how much you can deduct, you can take 15% of your income as a deduction for contributing that type of food. So that's an increase and a change, and that's a permanent change as well. The next page is starting on 12 with the sections entitled 179. 179 is an expensing provision that allows you to, unlike the depreciation, you immediately expense that item. So before we gave that example of the $100 for certain types of material, you just automatically expense that. And it was similar to all the depreciation that was extended through bonus. This is now made permanent and adjusted for inflation. So they can immediately, companies and individuals can take that up to that $500,000 immediately. And you can see some of those on page 13 are examples of what they are. Air conditioning and heating units are now eligible property. Off-the-shelf software is permanently mine safety equipment. You could go on and look at what section 179 is to see the types of things that can be immediately expensed instead of depreciated.
I'd like to back up, if you don't mind, just for a second, to the top item on page 12.
Okay.
Reading it quickly, I wasn't able to ascertain whether this applies to farmers who contribute part of their crop to the Oregon Food Bank, for example. Would it apply to them?
I think it's any inventory, so the farmers would have inventory,
right.
Yes.
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 Yeah. Okay.
Yes, and some of the things I didn't cover on that, Chair Barnhart, were it talks a little bit about what the how you actually value that food, because if it's going away, how do you value food that you would otherwise dispose of? So it gives you some leniency that actually creates more benefit to be able to donate that food.
Right. Thank you. We have a we have a tax credit that's related to that issue.
The gleaning.
And trying to make certain that we use similar definitions is probably useful. Yeah. I have no idea whether we do or not.
I'm not sure between the interaction between the code and the actual the gleaning credit or not.
Right.
Yeah. If we flip to page 14, these are, again, are just examples of expenses that can be similar to the 179, but they're for specific types of taxpayers. Theatrical, for example, 181, it's the theatrical productions get a permanent expense deduction for certain for qualifying property. Film and television productions on 188.1F get it for 2 years. So just certain types of industries, again, that Congress has said get a deduction. The 222E is for individuals, and that's the qualified tuition deduction. That, again, is just a two-year extension, not a permanent extension. And the other ones on these pages are all very, very technical foreign inclusions of income.
Excuse me, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just ask about that tuition? Do you have to be the person going to school, or is that something a parent can use to deduct if they're paying tuition costs for their dependent child?
You do more individuals, Heather?
So basically, if it's a parent and a child, and if the parent is claiming the child as a dependent, the parent can deduct the tuition.
Can. Okay.
There's income limitations.
There are income and phase-out limitations, but it's whoever's claiming the dependency. So if the child is claiming their own dependency, then they get it. Mm-hmm. But if the parents are claiming the dependency, the parents get it, potentially.
That sounds like a good deal.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the last one I will cover before turning it over is that 355H, and that's for REITs. There was a lot of real estate investment trust, and there's been a lot of press about real estate investment trust, and Congress decided that certain corporations could not spin off their real estate assets into a real estate investment trust. So Oregon, again, would follow that and not allow them to spin that off. All right.
Okay. I'm going to move on. We're at the number 402 at the bottom of page 15. There's this one deals with the specific rules for airline industry. So that one's about as much as I'm going to say. Airline industries, we don't tend to do a lot in the state of Oregon. And on the next page, 16, 403 is church clarifying their retirement plans. The one I'm going to spend some time on is 408D, which is the IRA distributions. This is back. It's permanent. This is for people 70 and a half that can donate up to $100,000 straight from their brokerage IRA over to a charity, and there is no income and there's no tax, obviously no tax donation, but at least you get to move the money to a charity tax-free. That is made permanent and usually is a big deal. The next few, so starting on page 16 again, on 408, the next few are just business transaction guidelines for very specific type of businesses. So like 408 is small businesses and their simple IRA, and it tweaks the rule for simple IRAs and what you can do with them. Then we move on to 451. Those are the electric type of vehicles and how to treat those. On page 17, we have a long-term contract for 60, how to treat those on specific contracts. And then the last one is research for 501, research on lobbying expenses. So those are very detailed, specific type of transactions. On page 18, Code Section 506 and 512, this deals with exempt organizations that they now have to register with the IRS and some laws regarding that. Another one that might be of interest is on the bottom of page 18, it's the 529A, which is the ABLE accounts. It used to be if you had an ABLE account set up, the beneficiary of that ABLE account had to be in the state that the ABLE account set up in. That is gone, so the beneficiary could be in Oregon and the account could be set up in California if you had grandparents or so forth. So the state restriction has been removed. So if that's of interest. On to page 19. We have the three on this page, the 529s. This is dealing with the 529 education plans.
the qualified tuition. There's just a couple of changes. They clarified some things that didn't really matter, but could. Like if you took money out and the school refunded you your money because you didn't actually take that class or you dropped out or whatever, you can actually take the money and put it back into your 529 with no harm, no foul. That's a rule now. It was a gray area. Let's see here if there was another. So the other kind of major change is now you can buy computers, you can buy, you know, if you're in camera, you know, things that are not just books and your tuition now qualify as education expenses. And the last line on page 19 kind of goes over some of those items in a little more detail. On to page 20. If I'm going too fast, please slow me down. I'm just trying to hit highlights. So on page 20, the first two cover the REITs, the real estate investment trusts. Again, a lot of these are just tweaking the rules that are there, and they're very complicated, and they really don't have a practical way for us to disconnect at this point. On page 20, 664E, this is the charitable remainder trusts. Before, if you had an early termination of one of those, there was no clear rules as to what to do if it was a final year or each year going on. They now have a rule. They put it in place for if it terminates within the year. They gave you some rules and rather than the gray line. On to page 21, the first one, 831. This is dealing with non-life insurance companies electing to be taxed as investment income. Very specific, it moves the dollar amount of premiums up from $1.2 million to $2.2 million and changes a few other items, adjusting for inflation. The 857, these are just more of the REITs that I had mentioned before and not really a lot of changes that are worth noting. And on to Susan.
So I will begin discussing parts with you on page 25, starting with section 953E. 953 through the next two down, 954, discuss subpart F, exceptions for.
Is she on the mic?
Sorry.
Is she being heard on the mic? The mic was aimed quite a ways from you, so I wanted to make sure we were picking you up.
I apologize. Provides for the treatment of certain insurance company income earned by foreign-based companies. Active financing income was excluded previously, and that exclusion's been made permanent. There's a look-through rule for related controlled foreign corporations passing dividends and interests. Rents and royalties, and that look-through rule has also been extended. Section 1016 is qualifying clean coal power grants are excluded from gross income for certain taxpayers. Section 1202 is the 100% gain exclusion for qualified small business stock. It's retroactively restored and made permanent. On page 26, 1367, the rule that S corporations' charitable contribution of property and shareholder basis, the Act made a decrease in an S corporation shareholder's basis for charitable contributions of property permanent. 1374D7 made permanent the shortened built-in gains holding period for S corporations, limited to 5 years. It made it permanent. Section 7508 refers to the collection period for taxes of armed forces members. They have certain extensions that they're allowed for periods of time whether they're injured or they're in a combat zone. So the collection period is 10 years plus actual time spent in a combat zone and not periods that are for hospitalizations when they've come home. On page 27, section 420, discusses the time during which a qualified transfer of excess pension plan assets can be made to retiree health accounts and not invoke tax sanctions. It's extended for 4 years. 1014 provides that the income tax basis of property acquired from a decedent cannot exceed the value used to determine estate tax. So when an individual inherits property, their tax basis must be similar to the estate or the same as the estate. Section 430, the use of favorable interest rates, and section, so 430H2 and 430H3, the extension of favorable interest rates for funding defined benefit pension plans. And plans that use a substitute mortality table must show how their actual results or performance differs from current tables in use. Was I clear? Because I kind of babbled through that one. I apologize.
Mm-hmm.
So on page 28, section 704 provides clarification on family partnership rules. More or less that the family partnership rules were not intended to provide an alternative test for whether a person is a partner in a partnership. Section 771 through 777 provide a single set of audit rules under Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act for electing large partnership audits. On page 29, section 222D6 kind of goes back to the college tuition. It credit that you had a comment or statement on earlier, it requires that the payee statement, the 1098T, that they're required to have that to assert the deduction.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is going back a few pages. I'm sorry, I was reminding myself of, I was looking up the difference between an S-Corp and a C-Corp.
Sure.
When you went through a place where I wanted to ask you. On page 26, the last thing on page 26, did you touch on this Cadillac tax while I was looking that up and was distracted? Or did you not talk about that?
I think that I might have skipped over it.
Okay,
so
no, that's fine.
It is actually kind of an interesting one. Cadillac tax.
Sounds interesting.
Right? It's a federal tax provision that provides a 40% excise tax on excess benefits provided to employees.
Right. Which currently isn't scheduled to go into effect until 2017, I believe.
It was delayed.
Yeah.
It was delayed. We have those sections or provision references back in Section E of our book. But this particular section will provide a deduction for the amount of tax paid by employers on excess employee benefits.
So that would seem to neutralize the impact of the Cadillac tax on the individual taxpayer / insurance policy holder, would it not? If you have a plan that gets charged the Cadillac tax, or maybe it's that the Cadillac tax is paid by the employer. So if it's paid by the employer, but the individual gets to, the employer gets to. So this sounds like it basically backdooredly gets rid of that Cadillac tax.
So before, you used to have to pay the tax on these plans, and it was non-deductible. Now they're allowing it a deduction for it, so it kind of eliminates the criteria.
Except it hasn't actually been implemented yet.
That is correct.
Right.
So and it's not always necessarily going to be a one for one.
Right.
Right, if you pay, because you could be in a loss situation, right, and you still would pay the tax if you had a Cadillac tax, but you have no ability to take the deduction.
Okay.
But on a normal profitable company,
just,
it kind of.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a fairly significant little tweak to put in there.
Yeah, I don't know if it would neutralize it, but it certainly would, like, dilute its impacts.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, this has been discussed quite a bit in the press around the issues of how we deal with the ACA,
mm-hmm.
And people not being ready to
and in this building,
right? Where people not being ready to deal with the appropriately large coverage for health insurance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've given away my position. Please go ahead.
Okay. And so we're on page 29, 104A, I believe. So death or disability compensation received by public safety officers and their dependents is excluded from gross income. The next page, page 30, we have section 170 and 170F. This act was specific to two New York police officer department detectives and provides for contributions for their families will qualify for a deduction, and that record substantiation of the phone bill for a text message, a donation by text message, mm-hmm. would be adequate substantiation for the donation.
This is dealing with a very specific instance, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's New York Police Department Detectives Mr. Liu and Ramos.
Yeah. Very specific.
So,
yes, please. Yes.
So this does not apply for, because this is a fairly common thing that happens now. The Red Cross says text, you know, pound help, and you will donate, you know, that's a $10 donation. So this is not saying that the phone bill is applicable for any text donation, just for this particular one?
Yes.
So, yeah, I think some of the distinctions are is if you give it to, like, the Red Cross, it already is a charitable organization, where if you give it to an individual, it's not a charitable necessarily. In this case, they said if it is given to the individual, it still counts as a charitable deduction.
But just these individuals.
Just these individuals, correct.
You cannot extrapolate from this at all. This is just, when I thought we wrote specific bills.
Yeah.
If you have a strong senator in the right committee.
Clearly.
In the right
Mr.
state.
Schumer. Sorry.
Okay. I'm going to move. So that kind of concludes Section A. So, again, just to remind you, all those provisions we talked about in Section A, if you guys choose to do nothing different, we would connect, and all those provisions would be enacted in Oregon.
And it's probably fair to say, in the discussion of the very last item we've just been discussing, it's not likely to have much effect in Oregon in any way. Because I suspect most of these contributions were made by people living in New York.
Oh, yes, for those, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
For the whole section.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then to level set on Section B. So Section B are items that were impacted by all these provisions but don't impact what we consider to be taxable income. So it doesn't flow through to the Oregon return. So, like, if you flip to page 31, you'll see, you know, there's an enhanced child tax credit, that 250. The 25A1 below, excuse me, the American Opportunity Tax Credit, those are specific federal tax credits that have nothing to do with what Oregon would do. Oregon has their own equivalent or not equivalent that, as the legislature has chosen. So most of this section is dealing with items like that. So I'm not planning on covering those unless you have some specific questions throughout. I'll cover a few of them just so you're aware of some changes that have an impact in Oregon. On page 32, section 41, that section is for the research and development credit. That is restored and permanently extended. So, again, that, as I mentioned earlier, that's been one of those that has always been extended from year to year. That is made permanent on a federal basis. For Oregon, what Oregon ties to the calculation, so determining if you have an item, does that item I'm spending, does that person I'm paying qualify for the research and development expense, we tie to that. But we don't tie to the credit amounts. And as you can see, we put some notes here. The Oregon actually has its own sunset provision, which would sunset in 2018. So just by the federal government extending it permanently doesn't mean Oregon does. It just means Oregon still kind of calculates it in the same methodology.
Right. That's our R&D tax credit.
That's correct.
Yep.
The only other thing I'm going to cover, and they're scattered throughout here, but if you turn to page 42, and I don't know why Congress enacted it as part of Fixing America's Service Transportation Act, but legislative revenue staff indicated that there's been some amendments, and these are all with dealing with tax return due dates. And I apologize, the committee, our CPA committee, did not see the amendment, so we're not sure what the changes were. But let me tell you kind of, let me explain to you what's really happening and what was driving Congress to this. So there were a number of different due dates for partnerships, corporations, and other types of items. I have my magic chart that we made at lunch. And what Congress had done was partnerships were typically due 415 at the federal level and S-corps were due 315. What people were struggling with as an individual is getting a flow through and getting a partnership K-1 on 415, and your individual return was due 415. It didn't allow you time to get that information. So it's what Congress did is they said, well, now those are all for partnerships and S-corporations. Those are now going to be due 315. And so you'll have time to get that. Now, they allow a six-month extension to 915, which, again, so if an individual extends, the individual extension is on 1015. Mm-hmm. So it kind of gives that individual or, you know, if you have a corporation that owns a partnership or another flow-through, that gives them time to file their return, gives them a month. What it did for corporations, then it changed corporations being due on 315 to 415. Regular corporations. Trust stayed the same, both being 415. You know, and this is if you were a calendar year regular taxpayer. Obviously, there's differences if you had a fiscal year. Oregon was connected in one of two ways. They weren't connected necessarily in these provisions. Like for partnerships, the statute says right now it's due the 15th day of the fourth month. So in effect, now it matches federal just because the way it's worded. For other provisions, it had said it's due 30 days after the federal due date. Mm-hmm. So now if Congress changed that federal due date to 315, then Oregon goes to 415.
Maybe.
Right. No. Yeah. If nothing changes, right. And then on corporations, 315, the corporations were due 315. Now the Congress has changed that to 415. The statute says it's 30 days after the federal number, so therefore it's 515.
I think that's assuming we connect at the new connect date.
Correct.
If we don't connect at the new connect date, then the old rule would still apply.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Well, it still says 30 days after.
Right, but it's in the code that would be the one we connected to, not the most recent
that's
one.
Correct.
Unless we connect to the most recent.
Unless you connect to the
right. That's
right.
Part of the little dancing that we do, trying to figure out how the federal tax system has changed, and the way in which we connect. Some of it we connect because of our constitutional provision and the statute that says we connect via that constitutional provision, and others we actually have to update the date.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that would be, you know, so even though we're not really connecting from the in the sense of the way we did with A, automatic connect to federal taxable
right.
income or things, these were important changes that Congress put in place that you need to consider. You know, as a society, you know, we kind of the way if you connected, we still think that those would be very similar to what's happening now.
Yeah.
Heather, Ms. Jackson's client base, for example, we were talking earlier, it would allow her time to get the partnership returns, and then that allow all the individuals if Oregon followed that extra 30 days again. In my practice with multi-state corporations, you have to prepare your federal return, and if your federal return is due 10/15, then you have to prepare all your state returns on the same date as you're preparing your federal return, and that can be overwhelming. There just isn't enough time to get that information. And so most states, there's a few states that follow that same exact federal date that your return is due. Most states will say, no, we'll give you that extra 30 days to allow some leeway, get your federal return done, understand what happened there, then apply it to the states. So,
and I'm told that the Dash 1 amendment actually covers exactly this point.
That's yeah. I assumed it would have, so I wanted to make sure you understood, and we at least were, you know, we're concerned and aware of the issue. So you know, however it plays out. So I think that covers all the Section B's that we had that I thought were relevant.
All right. If you would please turn to page 49. It's Section C. So these are ones that we deem that Oregon probably, in our view, need to make a change to conform with the federal provision. So if you did nothing, we would be different than federal. So these are things we're asking for you guys to do something on so that we can more closely match the federal government. The 32s, the first three on page 49, these are the earned income credit. So I know that we have, Oregon has an earned income credit. It is a percent of federal. So I'm going to cover federal and then discuss Oregon. Mm-hmm. So for federal purposes, if you have three or more children, the credit is now 45%. It's gone up, and that is made permanent. So it's not a every year kind of a discussion. It's made permanent. The other big thing is that you have to have the person's, the dependent social security number before you can file. It's not applied for anymore. You physically have to have that number. So if you need to get an extension to claim the credit, then get an extension. So those are the basics of the federal change. For Oregon, right now it's effective 1/1/14 and forward that we get in Oregon 8% of the federal credit. So however we calculate the federal credit, we'll take 8% of it on the Oregon return. So by the federal government upping the credit for the three and more qualified people to 45%, 8% will make it more. So just so you're aware that that is changing. Any questions on that one?
Well, I think I have the same issue that I did on the other one. I think we have to actually connect
yes.
to the new yeah. date.
Yes.
Otherwise, it doesn't apply automatically to
that
us.
That is correct.
Okay.
This one is definite that you have to, Section
yeah.
C. It's,
right.
You guys have to do something to connect.
Right. Thank you. And that's exactly what Section C is all about.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll stop talking about that.
Oh, that's okay. So then 41H, this is the research credit for small businesses. They can choose to or elect to apply it to payroll taxes. It goes on the Form 941 when they file their federal quarterly taxes. And for right now, because Oregon is not tied to this, there is a, let's see, how do I word this? So then the credit gets changed when it comes over into Oregon. It can be, it would be a lower credit to Oregon because it's not being taken on the federal return, it's taken through payroll. So they're changing how the credit's taken. So right now, the credit that people are taking for Oregon would almost disappear because there's no credit anymore for the federal level. And you are tied to the credit on the tax return. And now they can elect through payroll.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Representative Davis.
Thank you. This, very interesting. Do you know what qualifies for a startup small business? Any idea? I know I'm putting you on the spot with a very particular question.
I don't know what actually that...
So what's the ambit of businesses that might be able to qualify for the payroll tax credit?
I don't remember the dollar amount that it was.
Okay.
I don't remember that. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to look it up?
Well, this area has been ripe for discussion every session, R&D credit, so it'd be good to know.
Yeah.
It would be an interesting point, wouldn't it? Yeah, and it also depends on what the denominator is. Is it gross sales? Is it net income?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Yeah.
And this is actually pulling that out of that calculation because that calculation is the 41 and the way Oregon's doing it and making a whole new credit for Oregon for federal purposes, right? So it's pulling it out of that calculation.
Right.
So any Oregon business that elects that for Fed would never get it. Because you're pulling it out of the calculation. So a payroll expense, if I had a $500 payroll expense, I'm pulling it out of the calculation because Oregon follows those federal calculations
right.
to get the new credit. And Oregon doesn't have the equivalent of a new credit.
Right. So you'd get the federal credit, but there'd be nothing happening in Oregon.
For those
payroll particular
wages.
Thing. Okay.
That is correct.
Interesting.
That's just why we're on this committee.
Yeah.
Keep you engaged. Please.
Okay. Then on the section 199, we're still on page 49, this is the domestic production activities credit. They added Puerto Rico several years ago. I believe it was, several years ago. I don't remember. But basically, this allows for Puerto Rico to qualify, and right now Oregon is an add back because you don't follow it. So as long as you choose not to follow it, you don't have to do anything because this is just a change to that.
Okay.
But we wanted to bring it up that Puerto Rico got added, and and is extended until the end of 17, so extended 3 years. So on to page 50. This one is, again, the section 199, except for this is for oil refineries and how they calculate it. Again, a very specific calculation for the domestic production, and we're not tied to it. So if this was an interest to you, that's why it's here. Is right now we're not tied, and if you had interest in these two areas, this is where they made some significant changes.
Thank you.
So that covers everything we are recommending that you know that should be an issue.
So our remaining sections are D and E. They're both, we'll cover really quickly and kind of at a high level. D, to remind you, as we don't think that there's a change necessary. There are provisions within D reference a tax code, but do not impact tax law. Anything that we thought was important, we've included in the previous three sections and have discussed them with you. Section E is the acts reference a tax code, again, but do not impact income tax law. And anything that would have been of interest, we marked with an asterisk. I don't believe that we had anything that's really of interest. So on page 51, protecting Americans from tax hikes, there was provisions for tax court rules and defining the tax court administrative powers were broadened. Internal Revenue Service employees are required to be made aware of taxpayer rights. Page 52, there's a couple of sections. You don't get a passport if you have an unpaid tax liability. Federally, changes in procedures that for certain lawsuits. So no suit for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax. Whether or not that person is the one against whom the tax is assessed. On page 53, we begin section E. Most of section E is excise tax credits that were in, like, set to expire and have been extended.
Excuse me, Suzanne. Uh-huh. And Representative Smith Warner, if you look on page 53, you do see that your question on the Cadillac tax is answered there, that it's 19 that it's extended to.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Although I'm not sure those are the same. I don't believe that that fee is the same as the Cadillac tax. I believe those are two separate fees. And that one has just never, this one has never been implemented from the start. And the Cadillac tax is a separate one that was never due to, because the premise was that it would be, you know, a couple year implementation. And then as costs got adjusted, the hope was after that intro point, then the Cadillac one swings in with the threat of that coming. But given that this, for example, hasn't come in, that also, and now the Cadillac one is now going to be officially deductible, it's just, it's interesting. Because we talk a lot about here in this building about how, what our liability under the Cadillac tax might be in the future. So,
okay.
But yes, thank you. That's a great point. And it's, that's also interesting because that's a whole another fee that's just never even started.
Fuel excise tax rates, a lot of transportation industry tax rates on page 54. Page 55, the only thing that's not an excise tax extension is the Bipartisan Budget Act 2015. The due date for pension benefit guarantee corporations is extended a month. And more for on the last page, 56, for our police officers from New York.
Okay. Are there any questions, additional questions for this panel? We really appreciate very much the work that you do. I know that you do the work partly for yourselves, but also it's extremely useful to us to have this kind of an analysis and a review of something which for us is a technical bill, but adds terror to the possibility that we might miss something significant. And you're quite helpful in providing that information. We appreciate it, and we appreciate the society's ongoing work to help us with this issue. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 4025? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4025. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4131.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 4131 I think you had some reference to this, as you recall, with Secretary of State Audit's division. Briefed the committee, or January meeting, said they were working with Representative Taylor and the Department of Revenue on a bill, and this is it, House Bill 4131. There are two main elements to it. One is to require financial institutions to develop data match agreements with the Department of Revenue. That is to try to, the purpose of that is to try to identify assets held by delinquent debtors. As you recall, the audit report was on managing the state's delinquent debts. The bill also allows the Department of Revenue to enter into agreements with the Department of Justice's Division of Child Support to access employer data. So again, the idea is to better get at delinquent debts in the system. You have several amendments out there. You have a dash one and a dash four. You have a one and a dash four out there. And then you also have, these are all from Representative Taylor. So.
But we can look and see.
Yeah, you can look and see, yes, now, from the new rule. And you also have a kind of a consolidated LC, we call it LC work copy from Representative Taylor, which combines an additional amendment that's being worked on now. And we're hoping discussions with council to have that at least by Thursday. So we won't be quite ready for work session today, but you have a conceptual description of what that bill will look like, and that's in that LC work copy on OLIS.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you so much. For the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, House State Representative from House District 41. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 4131. This bill gives the Department of Revenue two meaningful tools to collect debt owed to the state of Oregon. My Senate co-chief sponsor for this bill is Senator Betsy Johnson, who unfortunately could not be here today, but wanted me to convey her strong support for this bill and her commitment to getting it passed on the Senate. Senate Bill 4131 is supported by the governor's office, and all of you should have received a letter from the governor herself, and the Department of Revenue, the Department of Justice, the Speaker's office, the credit unions, and the bill is based on recommendations from the 2015 Secretary of State's debt collection audit. Before I continue with the bill, some important background information of how this bill came to be. According to the Secretary of State's collection audit, liquidated and delinquent debt owed to the state has nearly doubled since 2008 to $3.2 billion, of which the Department of Revenue is responsible for collecting nearly $1 billion of that amount, mostly general fund dollars. Collection rates over that same period, however, have dropped. During the 2015 legislative session, we took steps to address our state's debt collection problem by passing Senate Bill 55. Senate Bill 55 is a bill I championed with others to improve collection efforts by creating a centralized oversight function on debt collection within DAS as a resource for all state agencies to rely upon and taking the first steps towards starting a vendor offset program. The Secretary of State's audit contained additional recommendations which were not included in Senate Bill 55. Jamie Rawls from the Secretary of State's Audits Division is here to speak about the details of the audit, though I know the committee is familiar with this work since Jamie was just here on January 14th. House Bill 4131 contains two of the recommendations from the audit to improve the state's debt collection. These two tools include accessing the data in the new hire report sooner and utilizing financial institution data matching to more efficiently issue bank levies or garnishments on debtor accounts, if law permits. These tools are being used in some other states, and Department of Revenue is here to answer questions about that practice. In addition, the Department of Justice Division of Child Support uses these methods to collect unpaid child support payments. Currently, employers are required to submit the names and relevant information of new and rehired employees to state child support collectors within 20 days of the hiring date. Currently, Department of Revenue has to rely on the Employment Department to share that quarterly employer data, which is not reported for months and is not available until after the payroll tax returns are processed, nearly 6 months after the employee was hired. The audit recommends Department of Revenue also be given access to this information to the new hire report at the same time in order to assist with wage garnishments and to locate wage earners who are not paying taxes or fines owed to the state or local jurisdictions. House Bill 4131 allows Department of Revenue access to this useful information sooner, which would make their collection efforts more efficient and effective. House Bill 4131 also requires financial institutions to do data matches with the Department of Revenue. Data matching is known to be an effective tool to determine where a debtor account is located. Currently, in order for Department of Revenue to find out where an account is held, the department has to request that information from each bank individually. Obviously, this is very inefficient, and each request costs the Department of Revenue approximately $10 per debtor. This is a general overview of what the bill does, and I'm going to turn it over now to Jamie Rawls to update you, to remind you, she's from the Secretary of State's Audits Division, as you know, to discuss the recommendations. And then we have Deanna Mack here from the Department of Revenue. She's the legislative coordinator, and she's going to go over the details of the bill. And then we also have here Assistant Attorney General Michael Ritchie to answer questions regarding the new hire reporting process. And we have the Assistant Attorney from Department of Justice for the Division of Child Support, and he can answer questions regarding the data matching. And then we also, of course, have LC here to answer questions overall. So we can give you all the information you would like, but also we don't want to go on too long. But also, I believe the Oregon Bankers Association is here to testify. We've been working with them, and they may be requesting some additional changes, which we are happy to entertain. I ask that you support this bill, as well as the pending Dash 5 amendment, which incorporates the Dash 1 through Dash 4 amendments already on OLIS. The Dash 5 language is available for the work copy on OLIS. It's in publications right now, so that's why we don't have the formal copy available. So thank you, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee.
Thank you very much. I think we'll go with the rest of the panel, and then we'll go ask for a question.
Okay. Great.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Jamie Rawls. I'm a principal auditor with the Secretary of State Audits Division. I was the lead auditor on the audit that was released last year in September. As Representative Taylor mentioned, I was here earlier testifying, so I'll try and just cover brief little background on the objective of the audit, go right into the two tools that we had recommended in the audit, and then we can open it for questions later. Again, the objective of our audit was to determine if Oregon could improve collections of liquidated and delinquent debt. And specifically, we were looking to see if there were promising practices both within Oregon, around different agencies, as well as other states that could be replicated to improve collections. The impetus for the audit was a five-year trend of increasing delinquent debt, declining collection rates, and the lack of a statewide leadership overseeing the collection of the delinquent debt. To determine the best practices, we interviewed officials from the U.S. Department of Treasury and 15 states focused on collection best practices. From those interviews, we narrowed it down to focus on six states that all had appeared through our interviews to make improving collections a sustained priority and had similar demographics to Oregon, and like Oregon, had a state income tax. The six states we looked at more in depth were Colorado, Kentucky, Maryland, New Jersey, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. We also interviewed, obviously, extensively in the audit, the nine top debt holding agencies in Oregon. Through our research and discussion with other states and interviews with Oregon officials, we found tools that Oregon could consider to increase collections. Two of the tools we listed in our audit report were bank account levies, which I'll refer to as bank matching, and access to the DOJ new hire report. I'll start with the new hire report. So under federal child support law, employers are required to submit lists of new employees within roughly 20 days of hire for use by child support collectors. The employment department also receives the quarterly employer data on employees and wages, but this can be 3 to 6 month delay. And we found during the audit only 3 collection units have access to the more timely information. DOJ Child Support Unit, the Employment Department, and the Office of Payment and Recovery, which is a shared service of OHA and DHS. Those units talked about how successful that that tool was in collections. And DOR had mentioned in interviews they would like to receive access to the new hire report and believed it would improve their ability to garnish wages and identify wage garners or wage earners who have not yet filed taxes. It's also a way for them to locate debtors as well. DOR's research indicated that 8 state taxing authorities have access to the new hire information in their research, and those states included California and North Carolina, who appear to be in similar legal position to Oregon that their department had concluded. They first identified the issue in 2012 and had planned to seek legislation authorizing its access. However, as of August 2015, when we were conducting the audit, we had learned that they had not heard back from DOR's requests from DOJ's heard back from DOJ for requests for legal clarity. We first recommended expanded access to this in our 1997 audit. As speed is critical in collections, access to the new hire could allow agencies to garnish wages they might not have known about and also let collectors know where the debtor location is. The bank data matching, we had found when it comes to bank garnishment and levies that all but one of Oregon's largest debtor agencies have to guess where the debtor might be banking. Other states, including Wisconsin and California, have worked with financial institutions to implement broader statewide matching systems that allow them to quickly link the debtors to the specific bank accounts. In Oregon, we learned only one agency can match debtors to bank accounts for collection, and that's the Department of Justice Child Support. And that's a federal law. It's required through all 50 states. Other Oregon agencies have to send requests to banks where they believe the debtor has money. If there is a match and required authorizations in place, then they can take the money from the bank and send it to the agency. Sometimes collectors have access to canceled checks or other clues that allowed them to guess where they bank, but the lack of information deters filing bank account levy requests, which can carry fees to the agency. From our interviews with Wisconsin, we learned its statewide system includes data from about 500 banks operating in the state, and the state law requires it to participate. Wisconsin, similar to other states that we had interviewed, works with a third-party data manager they work as the middleman to kind of match the information from the state tax information to the banks. And we had found that they work in at least 37 other states doing some kind of financial institution data match, and then specifically could be up to 11 states that are doing things beyond the child support match. Wisconsin's annual report on delinquent debt showed that they had collected about $30 million in 2014 from bank levy collections, which was roughly 15% of their total collections. From review of these tools and some others, our audit recommended Oregon consider the use of collection tools by working with agencies in the legislature when necessary to implement new tools and to consider the bank data matching and work with DOJ to resolve legal issues around the new hire report.
Thank you very much. Please.
Yeah. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I will spare you the going over what the bill does, but I will go into a little bit more of the weeds, and I do want to give you a little bit of background on how we got to where we are today beyond what Jamie's already talked to you about. In 2009, the legislature considered a bill that would have required just this, the financial institution data match, modeled after the child support process. But because it was still largely a new component back then, it was still in its infancy for the state tax debt, and there was a lot of concerns raised about privacy during the legislative process, the bill did not pass. What did happen, though, was the department got a budget note asking us to study the viability of such a process, which we did during 2010, and we presented that paper to the legislature in March of 2011. Since then, 10 other states, 10 or 11 other states, I believe, actually have implemented the debt collection component beyond just the child support matching. The department has been working with industry partners that would be affected by this matching system to figure out ways to overcome the issues that they've had with it since 2010. That we believe that the concerns that they have raised over the years have been addressed in the Dash 5 amendments. The concerns that we have, I think, so far already resolved is, one, that the state shouldn't have access to financial institution information about customers who are not debtors, right? It makes sense. So in Section 2 of the Dash 5 Amendment, each financial institution would have the option to perform the match themselves with our information so they could retain their customers' privacy. And the state would not have possession of that data. Some financial institutions may not have the infrastructure to do the match themselves, so an alternate means to comply must be provided. So Section 2 of the Dash 5 Amendment is flexible enough that it does allow for the department to conduct the match or for us to hire a third-party vendor, as Jamie mentioned. And I do believe Representative Taylor provided the vendor that has been in contact with us the image online. It's from Informatics, and they have the states in which they're doing business. This is just one vendor. There are other vendors out there. Three, financial institutions should not be having to bear the cost of the match system like they did under the federal child support laws. And so in Section 2, Paragraph 3, Representative Taylor has said, yes, that makes perfect sense. You can have up to $2,500, your actual cost up to $2,500 for one-time costs, and then actual costs of doing the match ongoing of up to $150 per quarter per financial institution. So to assist with the overall cost of for the state to administer that, because we don't actually we don't want to have to pay for that cost, the bill actually authorizes the department to pass the cost of this process onto the debtor. There's some notice provisions in there so that that fee would be passed on to the debtor. We'd add $2 or $3 to every garnishment we issue for that purpose. Four, the financial institutions said that they need to have some sort of safe harbor provisions that ensure that they cannot be held liable by the customer for compliance with the data match laws. So paragraph 6 of Section 2 of the bill provides those requested safe harbor provisions. They were also concerned about confidentiality and improper use of customers' information. So Sections 4 and 5 of the bill address unlawful disclosure and limit the use of the information by the DOR to the collection of debts by the department. So we can't then in turn turn around and give it to our client agencies or anything like that. Additionally, Section 6 provides that a violation of these provisions by a state employee is essentially the same for an unlawful disclosure of tax information, which I know you've heard me tell you this before. It's a Class C felony punishable by those criminal offenses and also termination from state employment for 5 years. So if we do share this information, it's got a pretty harsh outcome for us. So we are not interested in doing that. Six, the penalty, there must be a penalty for noncompliance. We learned this from stakeholders as well as from other states. There must be a penalty for noncompliance to prevent bank shopping so that they don't just hop to one bank that doesn't do the financial institution matching, to ensure fair customer treatment so all people are treated equally, and to increase financial institution compliance. That's what we learned from other states. So Section 6 creates civil penalties of up to $1,000 for noncompliance by the financial institution. And it does provide the department that they can give them 30 days to come into compliance. But after that, if they don't, then they get another $1,000 penalty. And as you know, on all bills that we put through here, the devil is in the details, right? So in recognition of that, Section 9 of the bill gives the department rule writing authority to implement the data match component. It also requires the department to consult with stakeholders, such as banks and credit unions associations, as we develop the rules, which is a stronger requirement than is currently in the Administrative Procedures Act, where it's just an option for us to do. The rules process will fine-tune the how of the process, including technical specifications of the data transfer, the alternative method for matching for smaller institutions, and how costs will be certified to the department for reimbursement, as well as any other technical issues we discover over the next year and a half. The rules are required to be effective in the bill no later than July 1 of 2017. So that gives the state and the stakeholders more than a year to work through any implementation details. This timeline, we anticipate, gives us plenty of time to come back to the 2017 legislature in the event that we do identify any technical flaws that must be fixed by statute as opposed to the rules, rulemaking process. So Section 7 and 8 of the bill are conforming provisions to the substantive ones I've already gone over. Sections 10 and 11 implement the new hire reporting provisions. Section 12 corrects a technical issue I believe the DOJ can answer questions about if you have them. And as the representative indicated, the Secretary of State did issue this audit report, and other states are using them, and we want to be able to use them well as well. As stewards of taxpayers' monies, we believe we have the obligation to be as effective as we can when we're collecting debt that is owed to the state. So these tools will help us prioritize our work and help us focus on our collections efforts more appropriately. For these reasons, we ask you to support Representative Taylor's bill, as we believe it will currently help us collect the debt owed to the state of Oregon more effectively than we can now. And with that, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Well, there's quite a lot to absorb here. Questions for this panel? We have some people from the Department of Justice, and then from the banks to be heard after this. Please, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony and very hard work on this piece of legislation. I appreciate it. And if this was said, I apologize for missing it. But in the data match proposal, and you sort of preempted one of the primary concerns I would have about disclosure of private information, and in light of, you know, breaches that we're seeing both on the public and private side, the dangers that that could entail. So can we understand, and maybe the financial institutions can answer this, or DOR, what information would be transmitted as part of this?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor, the information that the department would give to the financial institution, I'm sorry.
Davis. We look a lot alike.
It's a compliment. I appreciate it. Thank you. Having a good day.
Okay. So what we would send to the financial institution would be the taxpayer identification number, so the SSN or FEIN, and their name. And the financial institution would say, yes, there's an account here, or no, there is not an account here. And I think the bill does require that they also tell us the amount that's in the account the day of the match. That isn't necessarily, I mean, that to us, that isn't necessarily important. It does help us prioritize the work, but if that's an issue or there's trouble with getting that, that's fine. But the data that we would be sending is the information we already have, Social Security number, federal identification number, and their name. So they can conduct the match, and then they would send us, yep, we have an account here, or no, we do not have an account here. And then we would issue a garnishment on a positive result if we do know that X Bank does have an account holder there.
Can I add something in addition, please, Ms. Chair Barnhart? Mm-hmm. And also just to clarify, this is only for people who have been identified as debtor, and there's a writ of garnishment. The action is being taken. This is not all of us, obviously, in the state who pay taxes. This is only for people who are in violation of not paying a tax or a fine to the state. And again, it's just that limited information. So
it would be that list.
Please, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it would be that list that would be sent. Is the list of statewide list of essentially who?
Right, Mr. Chair and Representative Davis. Any debtor that has a warrant issued for the collection of the debt, which generally takes about 90 days from the time the debt becomes delinquent. Becomes past due until they become a delinquent debtor, which is there's that window where they wouldn't. So they'd have to have a warrant on their account first.
Follow up. And this is getting into the minutia, but do we know how that transmittal would occur? Carrier pigeon, smoke signals.
God, let's hope never try to make this more efficient.
Unsecured email, you know, Facebook message.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that's the point of the rulemaking process for the next year and a half is to figure out the technical specifications, the schema, if it's standardized, how are we going to make this actually happen? So we can work with the financial institutions on sharing what data components, is it FTP, is it that kind of thing, to work through that. And those rules will be effective in another year and a half.
And Chair Barnhart, may I add something? Just thank you. And then in addition to that, we specifically wrote the bill so that we have about 190 some banks in Oregon. And this makes it so each bank enters into its own type of agreement, its own agreement, its own contract with the state. So that if we have a bank that's a very small local bank, that's going to be very different than if you're a multi-state, you know, big bank. So some of the big banks will maybe want to do the match internally. Mm-hmm. And a small bank, it even says in the bill, if you're so small that you'll be exempt.
Mm-hmm. Follow up on that. Yeah. What's the exemption level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, the amount, the exemption, I believe, is in, let me look. I don't know that there's an actual amount. It's in Section 2, Paragraph 5. It says the department may exempt a financial institution if it's not cost effective to do the match. So if they have California in their rules, they actually said if you have less than 250 account holders, then you're exempt in their rulemaking process. I envision we would probably do something like that. 250 doesn't seem like very many account holders, and they probably don't have the infrastructure or means to be able to do that. But we have to pay them to do that match as well. So I don't know what those rules would look like in Oregon compared to what's going on in California, but it does just say when it's not cost effective, that's the test.
Thank you.
Very good. Other questions, Representative Bence, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So two questions. The first one on financial institution, I guess we think banks and credit unions. Are there other? What about Charles Schwab? Is that a financial institution?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bence, that's a really good question, because in the working document that you have that's posted on OLIS, the paragraph in the definition section, paragraph 4C, I believe, is going to be deleted. And so we're looking at depositories here. So it says in paragraph C, any benefit association, insurance company, safe deposit box, or safe deposit company, mutual money market mutual fund or similar entity, that's actually going to be stricken from this bill. I think that they've already requested that amendment.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
Yes, please.
And I've forgotten the process to get to a warrant. Is that a final? Is that like a final judgment? Because I've forgotten the nature of that word warrant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, the first thing that happens when we do our collections process is either taxpayer files a return or we have some sort of a debt assigned to us, and we send them a letter with the bill. And then we give them, in the tax process, we give them about 30 days before we issue what's called a notice in demand for payment. And then 30 days after that, we issue the warrant. So it's anywhere from 60 to 90 days before we get to a point in time where we can issue a warrant. The warrant is the document that authorizes us to issue garnishments, to seize property, that kind of thing. So no collection action can happen until we have that warrant in place.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Right. So when I see warrants on title reports or other things of that nature, it has evolved to a point then where it's equated with a judgment. But even though there hasn't been a trial or anything of that nature, the taxpayer has had an opportunity to be heard before the warrant status is achieved.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bence, absolutely. The underlying debt has had appeal rights, has had all of that. That's what makes it become liquid and delinquent, right? All of that's resolved. If a warrant shows up on a title report, it's because we recorded it in the county, in a particular county. We don't have to record all of them. We do record a good chunk of them. And I think Michael Grant, who's our DOJ expert on collections for statewide kind of stuff, can answer more specifically those questions. But as far as from what I know, all of the appeals are underlying on the tax component before it ever even gets into collections. Then there's appeals for the garnishment process that goes to another, the Office of Administrative Hearings in the Court of Appeals.
Yep. Yeah, follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, the question I had asked the banks when they visited my office was whether or not there was a federal law prohibiting any of this. And I'm taking it that in your audit, that whatever is now being suggested complies with whatever the federal privacy laws are. Is that a correct statement? Have we had that exhaustively researched to the point of
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, it's what we had learned is it's essentially expanding that federal institution data match that's required for child support. So all the banks and the whole state, the whole nation, is doing this match for child support debt. And it's just expanding that to include either tax debt or tax debt and other debt. Some states, it's really a new and upcoming thing right now, and it's pretty fluid, but some states are doing it for other types of matches. So it's just expanding what is already there is how I understood it.
Right. If I kind of understood that. It's just that, of course, thank you, Mr. Chair. That expansion piece is where I would like to see our Department of Justice weigh in, and maybe they already have, saying that is just perfectly okay. And sure, I can certainly understand why there would be a waiver on child support. That makes absolute sense. Now, to expand into other things, I don't know. So that's my question.
Yeah, do you want to answer?
Should we have DOJ?
Yeah. Well, they're going to be up next. Yeah. So let's finish the questions for this panel, and then we'll talk to them. And maybe they can answer that in their direct testimony. Other questions for this panel? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question. I just wanted to tell the three of you that what a great presentation that was. Incredibly informative and thorough. You laid out a problem that clearly, since 1997, we have been having, and that the audit division has been waving flags about for a long time. And it's you've done really nice work, really thoroughly taking into account concerns, objections, and getting to a reasonable place. I think it's. I just wanted to thank you all for that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to second that that comment. I think it's very clear in a very difficult set of topics, and you've done a great job in about half an hour. Very helpful. Thank you. Let's hear from the two Michaels, Richie and Grant. Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ritchie. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice, and I work as the general counsel for the Oregon Child Support Program. I can tell you that generally I am here today to answer questions about sections 9 and 10 of the bill. I think it's 11 and 12 of the Dash 5 amendments, which relate to the providing the new hire information for employers. The Division of Child Support collaborated with the Department of Revenue in trying to develop a scheme that permits the sharing of that data without violating federal confidentiality laws. The solution we finally hit on was the manner in which that data is collected. It's actually submitted by employers on an online web portal. And that data then has to be taken from that web portal, converted, and integrated into the confidential child support system. So if we intercept it before it's integrated into the confidential child support system, it's fair game, and that was what we concluded. We double-checked with our federal regulatory agency, the Office of Child Support Enforcement. They blessed that solution, provided, as I said, that it's pre-integration, which turns it into confidential information. So that's the solution we've hit on. That's what this bill seeks to implement, and I'd be happy to answer questions about that.
Thank you. You just answered, I think, Representative Mintz's question just a moment ago of the feds think this is okay. And I think
his question was about sharing banking information. I'm talking about sharing the new hire information. Quite all right. It was a valid question, and I want to make sure that I clarify.
Yes.
Yeah, my expertise is limited to the child support program and the way that the federal reporting works in that half of things.
Thank you. And it was my understanding that there was an issue of timing of when people got access to data and when they could use it. Is that still the case?
I believe the issue you're referring to has to do with currently it's permissible for the Department of Employment to share that information, but they get it much later than the Division of Child Support. So we've come up with a way for the Division of Child Support to share the information as soon as we get it, which was in 20 days of an event occurring.
So as a practical matter, the Division of Child Support has information, which they integrate into their own secret or private material. They use that information then to collect debts that are related to child support.
Correct.
In the meantime, the same information is also, under this bill, would also go to the Department of Revenue, and they would then subsequently use that same information to determine whether or not they had a tax debt that was due that they could collect upon. Am I generally right about that?
I think if you, from a big picture standpoint, you have correctly identified what the solution here is. I think to get into the weeds a little bit, the Division of Child Support is required by state law to enter into interagency agreement with a number of partner agencies that we cooperate with and that help us to acquire information we need to do the child support work. And we currently have an existing interagency agreement with the Department of Revenue. And this bill, mandates that interagency agreement be further developed to address the precise process, including the manner in which our two computer systems are going to interface.
And that's hence the delay in implementation.
The delay in implementation has to do with the other half of the bill.
Other half of the bill.
If I'm not mistaken, is that right, Deanna?
Yeah.
Okay, we're getting head nods all around. I apologize for interrupting.
No, that's quite all right. I'm ready for questions, but adding, I don't have anything else specific I need to say.
Thank you. Other questions for this Michael? So let's go to the other Michael.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Michael Grant, and I'm an attorney with the Oregon Department of Justice.
I assist a variety of state agencies with debt collection matters. And I have come here today. I don't need to rehash what was said very eloquently from the first panel, but I'm prepared to answer questions to the extent that I can do so about House Bill 4131. I should say, in anticipation of the committee's question about the interplay between federal banking privacy laws and House Bill 4131, I have not heard exactly what the banking community's concerns are with regard to federal statutes. And as I sit here, I feel a little bit nervous about trying to say what the department's position would be on whether there would be any problem between.
Well, we have at least one banker who's going to testify in a minute, so if you stick around, you might learn what their concerns are, if they have any, about that. Do you have a comment on Representative Bence's question?
Which question?
The question he asked involving the issue of privacy, federal privacy laws, and whether or not this bill may violate any of those. I think I've hit the essence of it, haven't I? Yeah.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that was what I was referring to, actually, okay, with the federal laws and how they would interplay here. Certainly, in Sections 4 and 5 of the bill, it's designed to ensure that the information is kept confidential and is only used for either the purposes of carrying out the financial institution data matches and collection of debts.
And we're not asking for any information that doesn't already go to other agencies. Is that correct?
To one other agency, the Division of Child Support.
Yes, thank you.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So there is a state agency that gets this information already.
Yes.
And we're talking about providing it now to the Department of Revenue in addition.
That is correct. And as the bill is drafted right now, they wouldn't be able to share it with other agencies. I think that's what Deanna Mack had said when she testified as well.
Right. Of course, they have their own sideboard issues that we try to jealously guard for them because of our relationship with the Internal Revenue Service. Right. Other questions for these two gentlemen? Don't be surprised if we're back to ask you more questions later, but we appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you very much.
Let's hear from Ken Sherman, and it looks like Alec Scheibel, perhaps. Oh, please bring the bankers panel up, and
I'm actually the insurance panel.
Well, let's have you after them, then after the bankers, then. Thank you. I didn't realize you had three. I only have one on the list.
My apologies. We were running, getting people to. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. To my far left is Betsy Steinberg, who is a vice president with Pioneer Trust Bank, is actively involved in several of our OBA committees that have looked at this issue, and she can actually give you some perspective from a community bank's take on this. I'm also joined today with Ken Sherman, our longtime Council, who you passed last session a rewrite of the Bank Act, a modernization of the Bank Act, and the man to my left is the one that's probably responsible more than anybody for putting that together. He has also worked extensively over the years in the issue or in the matter of garnishments, and in fact has written and rewritten and rewritten a garnishment manual for banks also over the past 25 or 30 years. So I think we have a couple of real experts in dealing with this, and I'm just going to be very brief and make a couple of introductory comments, then I will turn it over to Betsy. First of all, I want to make it clear to the committee that the Oregon Bankers Association supports the concept of what you're trying to do. You know, as you've heard, only 10 states have gone down this road. So while we have been discussing this issue since probably 2009, we in the association felt we need to see how it worked in other states, what kind of issues were fleshed out. And even today, as I say, you only have 10 states that have actually implemented that. And I think the Department of Revenue also said 10 or 11. We won't quibble over one state. But we do support the concept. In fact, in 2013, I guess, she said the bill was brought forward. We raised some concerns, among others. They actually came to our committee, Department of Revenue, in 2014, indicated they were not going to go forward with 2015. And we thought, mistakenly, I guess, that there was a pretty firm commitment between us and the Department of Revenue that we would work on this in 2017. And that was our goal. So we were really surprised when we got that, and we sure liked the short session getting the bills in advance, but we were very surprised to see this bill in the stack. And I can say I'm probably in trouble with the Oregon Bankers Association because Mr. Sherman, I can't even begin to count, I don't want to know because I don't have to pay his bill, the number of hours he spent just on the past week on this particular bill. And in fact, you know, we got the latest draft last night at 7:30. So it's really been a moving target, but I want to make it very clear on the record that as far as the concept is concerned, we are very, very supportive of that. One of the things we offered on a phone call last week with some of the DOJ folks is let's have one statute. Let's merge the child support statute with this one. So it's very clear to financial institutions how you deal with both of these. Very quickly, I don't even think we finished the statement, department just said, no, that will not work. So, you know, we would throw that out as a potential option that you try to merge the two statutes together. And we'd be happy to work on that. I don't think that's going to get much traction, but I wanted to throw it out that was one option that we had looked at. I notice you have the bill scheduled today for a work session. It's my understanding you're not quite ready yet.
Yeah, we're not working it today.
Okay, thank you. I just want to go on the record of saying that we're going to continue, and if I didn't, I don't think I did, so I apologize. I definitely want to thank Representative Taylor for her efforts in this area, for her willingness to work with us. You've heard that there's been a lot of changes to the bill as introduced, thanks to Representative Taylor hearing and the concerns of the Oregon Bankers Association, so we're very, very appreciative of that. And the last piece I'll have before I turn it over to Betsy, I hope everybody understands, and we're still trying to get information from these other 10 states. The way the bill is written goes well beyond tax collection. And I think that was mentioned a couple times, or at least it was stated as delinquent taxes. This goes well beyond that. The Department of Revenue, as I understand it, collects for local governments and others well over 100 different agencies. So it's very possible, I got the ticket anyway. For those of you in Portland, know this, it's $60 now for a parking ticket. And if you don't pay it very quickly, it's $120. So my check for $120 for parking where I thought I could, and it said I could indeed be one where they send a collection and could fall under this bill. So we would strongly encourage the committee to at least consider just passing the legislation this year on the tax piece, seeing how that works, and then perhaps adding in 17 the other agency piece. So that folks know out there that if you haven't paid your taxes, we're going to come after you. But as far as those other agencies, wait and see how this works before. And I have not seen any numbers that break down how much of what they think is out there is from delinquent taxes and how much is other agencies. So with that, I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you want everybody to finish and then do questions, but I'm happy to do it however the chair wishes.
I think given the nature of the time that we have, I'd rather hear from your your direct testimony first, and then we'll take what questions we have time for, recognizing that we want to hear from the insurance companies.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify. I'm Betsy Steinberg. I'm a vice president with Pioneer Trust Bank. Our main office is about 5 blocks that way. My office, which is the only branch of our bank, is about 10 blocks that way. And I've been with Pioneer Trust Bank for 31 years. And as a small financial institution, I wear many, many hats. And some of the responsibilities I have, I respond to the garnishments and levies our bank receives from my office. And those include garnishments from both the Child Support Division and as well as the Department of Revenue. So I'm familiar with the process and the searches to see if we have accounts on file. I'm also part of our bank and compliance team. I'm familiar with some of the privacy statutes that have been discussed today. I am also responsible for some of the primary relation. I'm the primary contact for some of the relationships of third parties that have access to our client information, the confidential information. And so that means I negotiate contracts and look at the how that information is used and utilized and ensure that it's maintained confidential. And I would echo, before I go into some of my comments, I'd like to echo, Tim said, I support the whole concept of data match. We're already doing it on child support division that is federally mandated. I think it's a great tool if it were properly executed within statute, you know, to collect revenues and keep the confidentiality of the data intact at the same time. And that's my biggest concern. So, as I mentioned, one of the things I do is oversee, you know, some of these third-party relationships. There is a statute that covers this. It's the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. I also do compliance for my institution. One of the first things I did, looking at this bill and entering into a relationship with the state for other data, is looked at that act to see, okay, can we do this or not do this? And again, I'm not an expert in the area, but from what I see, it's very clearly, the child support division is clearly spelled out. Then there's a little sentence that says, or any other requirement required by state statute. So to me, that means that if it's in Oregon statute, then I am okay to share the information. Okay, so I hope that kind of addresses some of the questions that came up earlier. I'm not an expert. Would love to have somebody with the Department of Justice look at that. I have not had a chance to read some of the commentaries specific to that part of the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. But just on a cursory glance, both our compliance officer and I think, yeah, we can participate. So moving forward, then, when I enter into a relationship, I look at some of the guidances that have been issued regarding sharing information with third parties. And there are several. I brought one here today that's from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Kind of lays out, this is what you should be looking for in any agreements or any arrangements that you have to make sure that this information is used and confidential. So some of the things we look for in agreements and in any other documentation would be the purpose for sharing the customer information, identification of the type and confidential nature, and a definition of the confidential nature of the information which will be shared, just up front saying, you know, this is, you can use it for this purpose and this purpose only. Limitations on the purpose, use and access of the information, and provisions to ensure secure transmission, storage, and destruction of confidential information. Those are key elements. And when I reviewed this bill, it doesn't hit the mark for me. It really doesn't. The purpose is not clearly defined, as I understand. It is to issue a writ of garnishment, but it doesn't really say that specifically. It just says that debtors that owe a debt to the state, you know, are subject to this match. So I'd like to see a little bit clearer definitions along those lines. Again, as Tim pointed out, I hear that this is used by the state to collect past due taxes, but in reality, if they use the term warrant, it expands far beyond that. And as such, I would like to see that in the statute, so that if I get, you know, Tim's my customer and we have a data match and he calls me, how did Malheur County or Portland City know that I had an account with their bank? I can, you know, again, I can't really tell them, is the way the statute's written. But at least there's some structure in the statute itself that he could go look at because of our disclosure and our agreements. But again, it kind of puts us out in the middle and puts it back on, you know, it's here, we're just complying with state statute. We're not overstepping our bounds and giving them information. Again, and I would also like to have a section in the bill clearly define the confidential nature of this information. I think it's okay to say that this is the DOR, the Department of Revenue is going to use it to collect data. I'd like to see language basically limiting the use, access, and who has permission to do this. Who it's going to share any the information with, if they're going to cross-share with the Child Support Division, I'd like that spelled out. Kind of rule of thumb, the more specific you can be regarding this information, the better, the less likelihood there's going to be misuse of it. And then, again, as I mentioned, this bill, there's nothing in it that I could find that has language ensuring secure transmission of that information, storage of that information, and destruction of that information, you know, how it's going to be disposed of. One of the things that I think was also discussed, and I don't know where the $2,500 came from as far as the production costs, and you understand there are various methods that financial institutions will have to make, adjustments will have to make to be able to institute this. I talked with our IT department, and you know, we're fairly typical of a lot of smaller institutions. Data matches, I think most banks would probably prefer to do in-house. I can't speak to credit unions or other entities under this. We would just as soon not release any third-party data that's not necessary. So we don't have a proprietary system. We actually have a third-party system that we've purchased. I have to go back to them and say, I need to have you make these changes so that I can comply with Oregon statute. Different when it's a national requirement like the child support, where they have to make it for all their clients in the country versus the 10 of us that are in the state of Oregon. And the 10 of us would have to share those costs, and they could be tens of thousands of dollars, just depending on exactly where they're coming from. If it piggybacks on the child support, we may be okay, but again, without knowing the specifics, it could far exceed the $2,500 that's in the bill itself. We're also at their mercy. If they can't comply with it, then we're going to have to find an alternative method, which may be more time-consuming and more costly for us on the ongoing basis. So there are logistic problems, again, that smaller institutions have. There are hard costs that we will have to absorb to comply. If the maximum we can get is $2,500 and I've been quoted $12,000, then I'm going to have to eat the remainder. Mm-hmm. I think the bill has some other issues that I think Ken Sherman's going to be addressing.
Right.
And in some of the conversations that I've participated in, there have been discussions about fixes in 2017 to make things right. That's a costly method of getting there. You know, but once it passes, I'm going to have to start contacting our vendors, making the programming changes, training staff, changing all of our disclosures. That could go all out the window in 2017 with a revision. And so I look at it from this standpoint, why would we go forward with something that's flawed? Why couldn't we maybe work together to get something that's going to work for all the parties involved? That's kind of my perspective on it. Again, want to reiterate, I support the concept very much so.
But please, we don't need a reiteration. Yeah. We're running out of time.
Okay. So
I'd really like to hear from your other panelist. Thank you. Unless you have additional points to make.
Nope.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. I have to start with a little story. I have been doing this work since 1977, and in my very first legislative session, my first job in drafting legislation was to draft what is now the Oregon Financial Records Privacy Act, which is at Chapter 192. And so the whole idea of that was to say that banks and other financial institutions may not release customer information willy-nilly to state and local government agencies. They have to follow these rules. So to me, this kind of feels like we're coming full circle. We're getting to a point where we're getting more and more information out there. And every time information that is private to our customer goes out the front door, there's this risk of security breach. And we know that that's great, and that the more people that information is shared with, the more likely there is to be a breach. So that's something that I think we all need to keep in mind. As my colleagues have said, we do support the concept of data match, and we do understand the problems that you're trying to address here. So we want to play a constructive role, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today and just share some thoughts. I'm going to get more specific, if I may, about things that we think would be helpful and constructive in getting to a draft that we can all get behind. And these are things that we haven't had a chance to share with our organization, that we're working on the fly, but we wanted to be responsive to your request for timely information. So I'm just going to kind of run through this hand-engrossed draft that I think you're working from and make a few points, if I may, and I'll try and do them very succinctly. First of all, on page 1 in line 11, you'll see the reference to safe deposit box, and that falls into the definition of an account. Well, if you know anything about safe deposit boxes, they're not accounts. And the problem with a safe deposit box is that the bank has no idea what's in the box. The only way that the bank can get it in the box is with the customer's cooperation. The customer's got a key, the bank's got a key, and the only way you get in that box is to have both keys or you drill the box. Now, I don't have personally any problem if you want to amend the bill so that we can provide you with information about who has a safe deposit box in addition to providing you with information about who has an account. But to lump safe deposit box into the definition of account really won't work because we can't tell you what you want to know about accounts regarding a safe deposit box. Literally, we don't know what's in the box, so we don't have any balance figure that we could give you. On section two, this is over on page two, we're talking about the frequency. This is at line seven. Data exchanges must occur no less than once per quarter. Literally, that means they could be hourly or daily or weekly or anything like that. California, which is the model for this legislation, has a no more than quarterly standard, and I believe that's a good place for Oregon to start. Down the road, if we find that this works, that it's not overly burdensome on either the department or the financial institutions, and you want to increase the frequency of these matches, fine. But let's start where California, with 5 years of experience under its belt, has started and has stayed. Also on page two, down in line 28, on the reimbursements, this draft is closer to the California than the earlier drafts that we've seen, but the per quarter reimbursement amount, the maximum, is $150 in your bill. In California, it's $250. It should be $250 based on the 5 years of experience in California. And as my colleague has said, we may very well have institutions and situations where the actual cost of the financial institution is going to exceed those maximums. So that jury's still out on that. On section four, this is on page four, line 27. This is where we're talking at the bottom of the page about this is this rule about you can't disclose, you can't tell somebody that.
Are you, excuse me, are you reviewing the original bill, House Bill 41?
No, I'm not. This is the hand engrossed version. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, let me look. As I look at the hand engrossed version, called Legislative Council Work Copy 226-2016. There are no line numbers in it, so that
that really hurts.
That does make it difficult. The other thing,
I apologize. We were given this by Representative Taylor last
night. I will note that in Section 1, you refer to accounts. The safe deposit box is missing from that item.
Oh, I love that.
And there are others. To save time, it would be extremely helpful if you could provide this to us in writing.
Okay.
We're not going to have a work session on it today.
I understand.
And we have to schedule a work session.
Sure.
So that will, at this point, it's going to be next week, isn't it?
Unless you carry it over.
Unless I carry it over, but we don't have the amendment that we
We're expecting the dash 5 tomorrow.
Okay, so we'll have the dash 5 tomorrow. We're not going to work it tomorrow. No. People need time to look at it.
Sure.
It would be extremely helpful if you could take the dash 5, uh-huh. take the original bill, and make the comments that are germane at that point, because it seems to several of us that the issues you're raising now have already been dealt with.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, indeed, several of those have been resolved. And again, we thank Representative Taylor for her efforts on that. There are still some. We won't take any more of the committee's time, but there are still some. And I guess what we may do, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, is once we do get some feedback from our bankers, seek somebody on the committee to have those amendments drafted so we can move forward in an expeditious manner. We've also talked to the Senate sponsor of the bill, and she's willing to continue working with it in the Senate if we need to do so. Senator Johnson.
All right. Let me ask you this. It appears as though we may have some time on Friday to continue this conversation. Would you like us to keep open the public hearing until Friday and allow you to come back and talk about the changes that we then have in place?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's necessary. It's certainly your decision. I think if you gave us till Monday to get our amendments ready and drafted before you work the bill, that would be great. If the committee decides, you know what, we're gonna punt to the Senate, you take those amendments and deal with them there, we'd be fine with that. But I don't think anybody here feels necessarily a need to come back on Friday unless you want them to come back.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the interest of time, I'd like to hear from our last witness, and I would very much appreciate. We have a very good list from Pioneer. It would be nice to have the list of the specifics once you've had a chance to look at the amendments that Representative Taylor's already proposed, and see if you have additional items. If you would, Mr. Sherman, that would be helpful.
Certainly.
Thank you. Yeah. 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 And before you leave, I'll simply say that we will plan to hold this hearing open until Friday.
Yeah.
We'll repost for Friday. We will carry over to Friday, and we'll post that information for Friday. Okay. We're also going to carry over the work session to Friday. Doesn't mean we're going to work it then. It means that we're going to look at it again and have another option.
Right.
And now we'll go to our final witness. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair, members of the committee who are left, Alex Schiebel, representing the American Insurance Association Nationwide and Mutual of Umanclaw Property Casualty Insurers. And it's rare that I will be very, very brief, because as I sat here, I heard that there's a solution to our problem, that insurance companies, as in the current draft, is very broadly defined and included, and property and casualty insurers don't hold individual accounts or properties for individuals, so they would be subject to this. But we heard the right thing. It's coming out, so that's all that I have. Just want to put that
on. You're no longer affected by the bill. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Colleagues, it appears that we seem to be running late most days.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get as much of our work done as we can. We are going to hold this bill over.
You'll technically have to hold it Thursday.
Okay. We will hold it for tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
My expectation is that we won't actually do any work tomorrow.
Any work on this bill.
Okay. But I'm told that technically I have to hold it over till tomorrow for both the public hearing and the work session. I expect that we'll do additional public hearing and potentially work session on Friday, although I don't know that absolutely at this point, on this bill, House Bill 4131. And with that, we'll close the public hearing today on House Bill 4131. Committee, thank you so much for staying late. And with that, the committee's adjourned. We'll see you tomorrow.
Pretty booked on tomorrow.